Bennett Cerf was a publisher, author, columnist, and TV personality who interacted with all the movers and shakers of his time. He was the force behind the creation of Random House in the mid-20th century. Cerf's life is documented in the new biography by Gail Feldman, Nothing Random. We're very lucky to be joined by her this morning. Good morning, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, Gail, what drew you to Bennett Cerf as a subject, and how did you decide what was most important to include in the book?
I have worked in the book business my whole life. I worked as an editor in London, and when I came to America and had trouble finding a job as an editor here, I became a journalist who wrote about the book business. I've been associated with Publishers Weekly for almost 40 years, and for some of those years was a senior staff editor. It seemed to me that you could tell the story of American book publishing and a lot of other stories connecting books to Broadway, to TV, Hollywood, and politics through Bennett Cerf's life. He had an extraordinary life, a kind of epic life, because he was the only American publisher who was ever really a public figure.
Before you get too deep into it, I also wanted you to tell us a little bit about how he grew up such that he met all these people that were right in his immediate world, if you will, and that's how he found his partners and his launch.
He was a native New Yorker who was born in what was then known as Jewish Harlem. He was a public school kid. He was a high school dropout. He tested into the only New York City public school in the early 20th century that was for academic students. If you got into that school, you could go to college for free at City College. And he had a gift for making friends. He met Richard Rodgers of Rodgers and Hammerstein as a kid. Also, Lorenz Hart went to summer camp with him of Rodgers and Hart. There were people who would become, you know, like the VP of publicity at one of the big movie studios who lived in his apartment building when he was a teenager. Having dropped out of high school, he didn't do his final year because his mother was dying. He managed to take night courses and tests that got him into Columbia University. And once he was at Columbia, his gift for making friends was supercharged. He became the editor of the humor magazine. He was very active on the student newspaper, and he met people. He could recognize others who were up and comers. And he met people who would be important to him, like fellow classmates, Richard Simon and Max Schuster, who founded a company called Simon and Schuster. Oscar Hammerstein, who partnered with Richard Rodgers. He met the lawyer who would become a partner in a major New York firm, Horace Manges, who would become the lawyer for many of the major publishing houses. He was on his way.
And he enters the publishing industry by purchasing Modern Library. Can you explain what that was?
Well, he enters the publishing industry in 1923 by going to work for a man named Horace Livright, who is the most extraordinary publisher that most people have never heard of. Livright published the first books of Hemingway, Faulkner, Eugene O'Neill. He published T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. And he published people from the Harlem Renaissance. And he was an extraordinary figure because he also produced plays on Broadway. He was the one who brought Bela Lugosi to play Dracula on Broadway. So Bennett had started out after Columbia working at a stockbridge, but he wanted to work in books or journalism. He'd had a double degree in from the Columbia Journalism School and Columbia College. So Dick Simon had worked for a couple of years for Horace Livewright. And when he and Max Schuster decided to start their own publishing company, he phoned his college friend Bennett and said, hey, do you want me to put in a word for you with Livewright? And Bennett got the job and sort of idolized Livewright and learned a tremendous amount from Livewright. Well, Livewright had founded the Modern Library, and Bennett saw it was his crown jewel. And when Livewright had financial problems, Bennett pounced. And Bennett and his best friend from Columbia, a man named Donald Klopfer, bought the Modern Library, and they became publishers.
It's so fascinating. And then they have to go through almost immediately the terrible economic hardships of the 30s and the upheaval of World War II. Did you want to address some of their creative endeavors that got them through those hard times?
They did a lot to improve the Modern Library physically and also in terms of the titles that they took on in terms of introductions they got from famous people, famous writers. And they went on the road themselves, and they were both very charming young men. And they really got sales greatly improved. They bought it for $200,000, and within 2 years they got their money back, and they were in the money, making a profit. In the Depression, people had very little money for entertainment. The two things they did were they went to the movies and they bought books. And everybody knew the Modern Library, and places like Macy's and Gimbel's offered it at incredibly cheap prices as loss leaders to get people in the door. So Bennett was in the rare position of making money during the Depression. And he and Donald even lent, I think it was $50,000 to their stockbroker, unheard of. And that's how they decided to start publishing not just reprints. The Modern Library was reprints. They wanted to publish new books. Bennett had told Dick Simon 3 weeks after he first started working for Livewright that within 10 years, he hoped to become one of the greatest publishers in America. And within 10 years, he did. Hmm. By then, he'd signed Eugene O'Neill, he'd signed Gertrude Stein, and he fought the court case that allowed James Joyce's Ulysses to be published legally in America, which was a landmark First Amendment anti-censorship court case.
You anticipated my next question, because as we were reading the book, I felt like when you got to the discussion of how we got Ulysses into this country, that was a pivot point. And that really was sort of a major change for what the role of Random House was in the American literary landscape. Is that right?
Ulysses put Random House on the map. And Bennett understood that it would put Random House on the map. They already published two of Joyce's books in the Modern Library. And they had met Joyce, but it was actually, and this is something that I unearthed that was not known in Joyce's scholarship. It was a personal connection that Bennett had with a partner in the stockbrokers where he had worked that really convinced Joyce to go with this young upstart Random House, because this fellow, this stockbroker, his sister was married to Joyce's son in Paris. And so Joyce's daughter-in-law and her brother, who would come and visit her from time to time in Paris, both worked to convince Joyce that Random House was the publisher that he should go with, because there were others who wanted to publish the book.
Was that your favorite author story, or was there?
It is. I mean, I found the daughter of the go-between, who then was in her 80s, because Bennett had made this offhand kind of teasing mention in an article he wrote after he won the Ulysses case, about this guy who'd said, you know, do you want me to talk to Mr. Joyce about your desire to publish his book? And I did New York Times archival searches and used the old New York phone directories to look up this woman's name, because I found a marriage announcement in the Times about her and got her husband's name. And he was a doctor. And I found a number and I phoned it. And I explained what I was doing. And this lady, who was then in her 80s, said to me, well, I have some papers and I think you might want to see them. And there were these letters and telegrams between Joyce and his son and this lady's father. It was the most remarkable archival find in all the years I worked on this book, and I worked on the book for 23 years.
I was going to ask you that. The book is an incredible compendium of stories and details, and I was going to ask how long it took to do it, because there is so much research that had to have gone into it. Any other favorite author stories?
Ira Levin, the author of Rosemary's Baby. I interviewed him for the book, and he liked Bennett, sir. But he told me a really good story. He said that, Bennett read the books he published. He was a voracious reader. And, you know, he'd go out to a cocktail party. He'd go then to dinner, then to the theater. Then he'd go to a place like the Persian Room or Toots Shores or El Morocco and come home. And he would read a manuscript until 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. And he read the manuscript of Rosemary's Baby. Mm. And he asked Ira Levin to come in to see him. And he said, you know, this is a very disturbing book. And, might you consider changing the ending so that Rosemary has an accident with a taxi and the baby is lost? Ira Levin said, well, Bennett, you know, I understand what you're saying, but I think that Rosemary has to have the baby. And Bennett said, it's your book? Okay.
Well, that leads me right to how Bennett gets to the intersection of publishing with Hollywood, Broadway, and television. He was, you know, somewhat of a maverick with publishing plays and getting the books picked up for movies and so on. Was that an unusual approach in that time?
Absolutely. I mean, there was a guy, an agent who was a hugely important agent named Swifty Lazar, who said that Bennett Cerf was the only book publisher who really knew how to sell to the movies. I think that's because Bennett Cerf was in love with the theater from the time he was a little kid and in love with movies. And he went after friends in the movie business and theatrical business. Both his wives came from Hollywood. His first wife, he had a disastrous first marriage that lasted 3 months, and that was to a Paramount star called Sylvia Sidney in the 30s. The second wife, who lasted, was a failed starlet, but her first cousin, who was like a sister, was named Ginger Rogers, and I do not think that she failed at all. And once he married Phyllis, more and more Hollywood people entered his life. I mean, already in the 30s, he'd gone on vacation with George Gershwin. By the time of the 60s, Frank Sinatra became a bosom buddy. And Mia Farrow, who was married to and then divorced from Sinatra during Bennett's friendship with Sinatra, said to me when I interviewed her that being in a room with Bennett was like stepping into sunlight. I mean, because he was on What's My Line from the early 1950s, he was on TV every Sunday night for 16 years. He came into millions and millions of Americans' homes every Sunday. There was something on What's My Line, a segment with a mystery guest, where the four panelists were blindfolded and they had to guess who this mystery guest was. And it was always someone incredibly famous from theater, from movies, from politics, industrial tycoons. So he knew everybody. And he and his wife had these marvelous, marvelous parties. They were written up in gossip columns as being, you know, the best dinner parties in New York City. And he would have authors like Truman Capote or William Styron sitting next to people like Richard Rogers, and he'd have people like the young Elizabeth Taylor show up, and they were magical.
You know, as you're reading the book, the topic you just discussed, I found myself really wishing that I would have been invited to one of those parties, because it sounds like they were just remarkable. I did want to ask you about the relationship with Dr. Seuss. How important was that and the advent of beginner books?
Bennett was not the first to publish Dr. Seuss. There was another publisher who published a couple of his books in the 1930s. But Bennett recognized that this man was a genius and courted him. And Dr. Seuss recognized that this guy was a really unusual publisher. And he signed on. And they published a number of books that did nicely, thank you. Bennett said to him he would publish whatever Dr. Seuss wrote. And Dr. Seuss's real name was Ted Geisel. And he and Bennett were very good friends because they shared a sense of humor, and they just sort of understood each other. And in the 1950s, Americans suddenly became very worried about the Soviet Union and a thing called Sputnik. And was the Soviet Union getting ahead of America? And suddenly people began writing articles in Life magazine and other places, you know, why can't Johnny read? And one of the articles said, we need people like Walt Disney and Dr. Seuss and Lewis Carroll, who is no longer with us, to write books, reading books, beginning readers for our children, get them hooked on reading.
Well, we don't have a lot of time left, but I want to also kind of skip to the end of why Random House is ultimately sold to RCIA, and if you have any comments on sort of the businessman that was Cerf.
Yeah. Cerf was visionary in terms of publishing. He said in the 50s or early 60s that there would be a half dozen major publishers. He wanted the company to grow. He bought Knopf, he bought Pantheon, but he also bought companies he didn't know anything about, educational companies, textbook companies. And he grew, I mean, the company had gone public in 1959, and it grew and grew and grew very rapidly. And then the stock started to go down, and he got very worried because people, all those Americans who watched him on TV, came up to him in the street and said, Bennett, I'm losing money on your company. Mm. And he got scared. And he sold the company to one of the biggest American companies of that day, RCA. And it was absolutely the wrong pairing. I mean, Random House was this tiny speck in RCA. And they didn't know what to do with it. And Bennett knew very soon that he'd made a disastrous mistake. And he couldn't take it back.
Yeah.
And it was sold. I mean, after he died, RCA sold it to Newhouse, to Advance. And then Newhouse sold it to Bertelsmann, who own it now. And, you know, it's part of a huge, huge conglomerate.
Yeah. The book is Nothing Random. It's the biography of the incredible life of Bennett Cerf. We've been talking to author Gail Feldman. Gail Feldman, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
We'll be right back after this.